Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Everybody to Nightlight. I want to thank Ken Quiet Hawk for his amazing introduction. There's no voice like his, for sure. Would love to have you check him out on the internet. Ken Quiet Hawk, he's a native storyteller, and he and his wife are preserving history in a very unique way. I'm really, really excited about today's show. I have Gary Lechman in with me again, and he is the author of many books on the links between consciousness, culture, and the Western esoteric tradition, including Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump, Lost Knowledge of the Imagination, Beyond the Robot, The Life and Work of Colin Wilson, and The Secret Teachers of the Western World, and a ton more. After the show, check him out on Amazon, because you'll find, as I have, that his material is fascinating and thought-provoking, and it will change the way you view your reality. His books are just profound, and I have thoroughly enjoyed the several that I have read and the many that are on my list of to-dos when I get a spare moment, or talk him into coming back on the show, of course. He writes for several journals in the U.S., U.K., and Europe. He lectures around the world, and his work has been translated into more than a dozen languages. Obviously, he has a lot to say. In a former life, he was the founding member of the pop group Blondie, and in 2006, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Talk about eclectic. Before moving to London in 96 and becoming a full-time writer, he studied philosophy, managed a metaphysical bookshop, taught English literature, and was a science writer for UCLA. He is an adjunct professor of transformative studies at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And the book we're going to be talking about today is a topic that has fascinated me, intrigued me, and I almost want to say titillated me. The book is The Quest for Hermes Trismegistus. And he's a character that I have been fascinated with ever since I heard of him. And I think this book was written just for me. So welcome to the show, Gary. I'm so glad you're here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on again, Barbara. And I'm very glad that you're enjoying the book.
Oh, it's like it was, you know, a lot of the stuff that you've written, and I've read a couple of your books now. You investigate so thoroughly into the topic that you've chosen that you make people stop and think about how they're viewing the subject matter. And I know in Holy Mother Russia, I came out of it with a profound change of perception as to the people of Russia and, you know, why they are like they are. And with this book, at the very end of the book, you do say, I think maybe we should all go back to the philosophy of Hermes Trismegistus, and I'm 100% with you. So, you know, you seem to have been writing for me. It's almost like you're my own private library. You know, you pick topics that I wanted to investigate. You do all the work, and then I get to chat with you about it. So it's a lovely relationship we have going on here. A lot of people haven't heard of Hermes Trismegistus, and
sure,
of course they've probably heard of Thoth, the antediluvian, mm-hmm. but Hermes Trismegistus is, of course, the name for Thoth, or Thoth is in there. Maybe we want to, you know, first tell people basically, historically, who he was.
Right, sure. Well, Hermes Trismegistus, and that means thrice great as Hermes. He's a, for a very long time, he was considered a real person, a real figure that lived in the ancient time. It's only, relatively in the last 400 years that scholarship came to the conclusion that he didn't really exist. He was a mythical or a fictional kind of figure. But he was thought to have been the founder of magic, the founder of learning and writing, and the alphabet and science and a variety of other scholarly and philosophical and magical kind of discipline and had all this knowledge. And he was believed to have written these texts, these books that came to be known as the Corpus Hermeticum, you know, the body of the Hermetic writing. And for one thing, those texts, when they were translated from the Greek into Latin in the mid-1400s or late-1400s, they had a profound influence on the Renaissance. And the fundamental vision is of the notion of the microcosm and the macrocosm. So if you know that idea that human beings, rather than just being one thing among many other things in the universe, or one animal among many, many other animals, we are actually a mini universe. We contain the entire universe within us. The macrocosm is the outer, you know, physical outer space. There's an inner space within us. That's the microcosm. And within us, we contain all of the forces and energies and laws and so on that operate out in the outer space. And that's a fundamental kind of metaphysical way that they see the place of mankind in the cosmos. And it's out of this that what we know is the Hermetic kind of sciences, like alchemy or astrology or magic, in the sense of being able to draw upon the powers of the different planets and so on and so on. So he's this kind of super mage, philosopher, sage that was thought to have been older than Plato and even older than Moses. And he was, there's even in places like Ravenna and others, in the Vatican, there are even chambers in the Vatican that are painted with images of Hermes. And for a brief time, he was considered kind of a fellow traveler as Jesus, or a precursor to Jesus. And then, as I said, in the 1600s, he lost his street cred because of scholarship unearthed that the books, the texts that he was supposed to have been, he was supposed to have written in the way back time, the Greek that they were written in was a Greek from a later time. So put it simply, it was a Greek from after Plato rather than before Plato. So it couldn't have been written at the time it was thought to have been written. And then, you know, it was realized that he was sort of mythical. The books were probably written about between 100 or 200 AD in Alexandria at this time, when there was a great kind of sort of spiritual, religious kind of melting pot there, with a variety of different religions and spiritual practices. There were the Hermetics, there was the Gnostics, there were early Christians, there were the indigenous Egyptians, and so on and so on. And what I did in that book was sort of it just fascinated me that you had a figure that was very, very important for a very long time, and then people believed it was actually real, and then it turned out that he wasn't. And then he's sort of the, he's sort of the head of the initiatic chain that is supposed to, you know, this wisdom has been carried down for ages and ages, and now it forms this kind of counterculture in the West, you know, the magic or magic or the occult or the hermetic, the esoteric kind of counter tradition to the Western tradition. Although, you know, as I point out in the book and other people have, you know, much of what we consider the official Western tradition is actually quite influenced by this as well.
Yeah, that's the one thing that you know, I understand that according to all of the that you've written, that you know, he was sort of like the he became like the head of this philosophy, but he didn't exist, so they needed somebody to pin it on. But when you talk about magic, and I've found this in other places too, that the magic they're referring to is astrology, is you know, your esoteric sciences, your meditation, your out of body experiences, your remote viewing. It's not the magic that we think of today, like rabbit out of a hat. Although in some places staffs turn into snakes and stuff like that. But it's
just. It's not stage magic. It's you know, sort of real magic with real powers and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what really fascinated me so much was that as I was reading about all of these philosophers and all of these different cultures and things like that that were taking on his philosophy that he was presenting, I mean, it's very much close to Christianity before it became a corporate entity. And the Jews, for some reason, don't recognize him, I believe, is what you said in the book.
I don't know. One of the things that happens in Alexandria at this time, and this is why where this figure Hermes Trismegistus comes from, is, as I said, it was a melting pot of different sort of religions and spiritual traditions. And what happened was that Greek gods and Egyptian gods started to blend together, or aspects or characteristics of Greek and Egyptian gods that were similar. They decided, you know, they were very syncretic. They were, let's put it together, you know. And so they put them together. And Hermes Trismegistus is a combination of the Egyptian god Thoth, who is the god of magic. He's the scribe. He's the ibis-headed god who, you know, has the pen, and you know, he's making a record, and again, he's the god of writing, and he's the one who helps Isis basically, you know, get pregnant by the dead Osiris in order to give birth to Horus and the Greek god Hermes, because at this time in Alexandria was Greco-Egyptian. It's an Egyptian, well, it's founded by Alexander the Great, but he had conquered, you know, Egypt at this time. And this is, you know, you find similarities. So in the sort of Judeo-Christian, I mean, yes, as you said, there was an argument in the early Renaissance about how Hermes was a precursor of Christ. And yes, there's a lot of similarities, you know, the relationship between Nous and Hermes and, you know, Jesus and God and Jesus and all of that, and the sun being very central and a variety of different, you know, kinds of things. You also find Enoch is from the Old Testament or the apocryphal books. He's considered sort of an equivalent to Hermes. And then later in the Islam, Idris the Islamic tradition is considered a equivalent to Hermes. And so this worked out well later on for the pagan, in the sense of Greek pagan, the followers of, you know, Plato or Hermes, when the Arabs took over because they were able to say, okay, well, you know, we are devotees of Hermes, and Hermes is Idris, to say, well, okay, you're part of the book. You belong to a religion in the book. So that served them well later. In later years, you know, when Alexandria was captured by the Arabs in the 600s. So you had this kind of blending going on a lot. And Hermes was considered a teacher of Jesus in some contexts. And so there was a good argument going on in around the 1500s that the Hermetic writings should have been made part of sort of Christian, you know, canon and so on. But it didn't come to that. But that was one of the fascinating things that happened there in Alexandria then, that you had all these different, you know, it was sort of like today in the kind of spiritual marketplace, you know, where you had a variety of different beliefs and available. And then you had this, what I call the Hermetic diaspora, where fundamentally when it's the rise of Christianity, when Christianity becomes the favored religion in later times, the Roman Empire, and then the official religion, then they start persecuting the pagans. That's the first ones they start persecuting, and they flee Alexandria, and then they spread out in different places, and you know it gets picked up in the Arab world there.
Well, I think what fascinated me about the book was that you went way back to the beginning, and you know brought it through Plato and Socrates, and then, you know, you brought it forward, and, you know, here and there I would recognize the name Swedenborg, and, you know, what I found fascinating was that if a text of any sort has credence or validity, it stands the test of time. And the Hermetica does stand the test of time. I mean, through generations and centuries, this material, you know, sometimes as with the Rosicrucians and you know, some of the others, it was underground, but it's still there. And I think that what amazes me and fascinates me with the material still to this day is that it stands and has great validity for a way to live your life that in today's times would be far better than Christianity, while it's fundamentally and down to basics fabulous, it has become a corporation, and therefore it has lost some of its magic because of it. And what fascinated me was how when you got to the Egyptians and when some of the advice was practice dying. I loved that part. It's sort of like, you know, letting go of the here and now and letting your conscious. I mean, there's a great deal about spirituality and allowing your spirit to soar. And I mean, you know, if there were a church of this philosophy, I'd be a founding member. That's what
well, there is.
Today
I mean,
is.
And, Well, I was
well,
just
yeah.
going to say that I would say that there is, in the sense that, you know, the whole, whatever you want to call it, the New Age or the sort of occult revival that started sort of in our time back in the 1960s and gradually became more part of, you know, mainstream culture, because there's a widespread interest in some of the fundamental ideas, because it is, like you were saying, out of the experiences, it's about, when you said practice dying, I mean, I start the book by asking, well, you know, we always talk about this wisdom from Egypt or this ancient knowledge that came out of Egypt. And so what exactly was that? You know, why did Pythagoras, he was supposed to have gone to school in Egypt. Plato was supposed to have gone to school in Egypt. It was sort of like the equivalent today where somebody goes backpacking in, you know, either, you know, in Asia or somewhere, you know, India or something. And, you know, back then, okay, yeah, everybody went to Egypt. And so what exactly was it, you know, that they learned there? And I brought in this interesting idea by his fellow Jeremy Nadler, who did a book about Plato and Egypt and this kind of shamanistic tradition in Egypt. And he relates, you know, this motif of sort of dismemberment that's in the shamanistic tradition, the shaman tradition. He goes through these experiences and he feels that his body is sort of you know, dismembered. It's all kind of cut up into bits and pieces. And he relates that to the story in Egyptian mythology about Osiris being killed by his brother Set. And Set cuts him up. And for the Egyptologist and alchemist, the French Egyptologist and alchemist, René Schwalo de Lubitsch, he equates this dismembering kind of motif with how the rational mind works, with what he calls cerebral consciousness. It breaks things up into bits and pieces, through analysis, it approaches analytical, and that's why it's so successful in science. But he sort of relates that to what he calls the intelligence of the heart, which is this. It's another way of knowing the world, which is more holistic. It's more participatory. It doesn't stand apart as something separate analyzing the world. It partakes of the world in.
Well, your book
is about with the intelligence of the heart. You can rise with and you can tumble with the boulder. So that what is that wisdom about? What does that come from? And it has to do with basically dying in the sense of quieting your body, so that your mind, your consciousness, can roam free. And this is what the Hermetics were about. They were about inducing these ecstatic states of what we've come to call cosmic consciousness.
Well, what's fascinating with your book is it kind of goes along with a lot of the other material I've been reading late, talking about how the hieroglyphs in Egypt were much more than people, understand them to be, that they were symbols of philosophies that have been lost in time, so to speak. And when you go into the Egyptian stuff, it does wake up a lot of the same material that I've been seeing in other places. It's almost as though when I read through it, it was like, this is what people have to learn. This is, you find that consciousness within yourself, because everybody's different, so it's a different way of finding it for each individual. And the one place that you talked about, one of the areas that are preserving this kind of philosophy are the Freemasons, which I found fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's many motifs and themes and symbols and images and even sort of rituals and things of that sort that have roots or are hermetic in the Masonic tradition. And I mean, this would go back to the earliest times. I mean, I'm not sort of expert on contemporary Freemasonry, and I'm not a Freemason, and I've not participated in any of these things. But I get the impression that if any of that that's still there now is just sort of part of the kind of dressing, the kind of ritual that they go through. But I don't think it's necessarily something that's fundamental to it now. Although in the earlier times. It was one of the ways in which this kind of tradition, because at a certain point, I mean, it really went underground with the rise of what we know as science, because it was a competitor. I mean, the Hermetic tradition by the beginning of the modern time, 17th century, the early 1600s, it was a competitor both to mainstream Christianity, the Church, and also to this rising, new contender of science, because it basically wanted to wed the two things together, the spiritual aspect of religion and the scientific, understanding of the world aspect, and it was a competitor to both. And strangely enough, the two things that became enemies soon after, the Church and science, sort of ganged up to get it out of the way. So it was based on a kind of real knowledge that was thought to threaten, the other, kind of power bases. And so other places, the Rosicrucians, they were sort of like the first kind of secret society. Did they really exist? You know, they were nicknamed the Invisibles because no one was ever to really find them. And there was a whole idea that it was a kind of hoax, but a hoax with a creative purpose in order to stimulate people into becoming Rosicrucians themselves. You know, rather than having to find them to join the club, you can start your own club and be your own Rosicrucian. And you could did that by following this kind of path. You know, that was based in this notion of what was called pan-sophy, meaning all wisdom. So it included the Hermetic, you know, pursuits and all that, but it also included, you know, the rising natural science and also a kind of progressive, more tolerant Christianity. Because that was another part of it, too, is the idea that all the religions come out of the same sort of fundamental insight, the same fundamental revelation. What we know today is the perennial philosophy. But this was something that was very, I mean, we say that now, but it was very cogent and urgent at the time, because you had all the, you know, the religious wars happening in Europe. You know, this is like the beginning of the 30 Years' War and all that, and they had the Protestant Reformation and all these kinds of things going on. So there was a real urgency to the idea that, you know, we need to get this message across that, you know, all the religions are sort of based on this, and, you know, Judaism as well. So, you know, so Catholicism, Protestantism, you know, the Eastern Church, Judaism, Islam, you know, today it's not as popular idea because we're back to this notion of everything being separate and fragmented, you know. So the we're all one idea in terms of religion isn't as popular because the whole notion of identity politics and people wanting to be, you know, their specific faith culture, but not being, you know, subsumed in some other bigger one and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating in that Christianity has changed over time in order to survive. Judaism, the same thing. And with this philosophy, this Hermetic philosophy, it's kind of risen into practice for a while, and then it's sunk again, and then there is an eternal part of it that comes through time and is adapted for the time in order for the philosophy to be practiced. And I think it's fascinating in that I can't think of anything else that has stood, that has survived in its entirety. I mean, the Magi were magicians, but they were also, you know, they had the same type of philosophy. They were called magicians, and yet they were studying science and spirit at the same time.
We get the word magic from the Magi.
So
they were the original magic. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of that tradition in the broader kind of, you know, Western esoteric, you know, the sort of the Chaldean oracles, which I mentioned, I think, in the book. But that's another one of these texts. These works that are these sort of prophetic, ecstatic, you know, kind of visionary writings about the nature of the universe. And, you know, fundamentally it's that, you know, spirit is, you know, the ideal realm, the realm of the, you know, the metaphysical, not the physical world. The physical world is, you know, the sort of the lowest on a kind of chain of being, and it's a radiation or emanation from some higher realm, but, you know, we're sunk in this physical realm here, and we have to reawaken our awareness of the divine. And, you know, that's a very kind of thumbnail sketch of it, but that's fundamental. So, and that's similar to the Hermetic, this awaken this spark of cosmic consciousness in us, which we can, you know, it says, you know, if you want to understand God, you have to become like God. And it says, you know, imagine yourself to be anywhere, and you're there in a moment, and you're back in the womb, or you're out, flying around the planet. So there's all these kind of, this whole idea that your mind is not, you know, I mean, we now in our modern day, the scientific view, you know, our mind is this kind of you know, steam that's given off by this lump of gray matter inside my skull now. And, you know, the whole idea that it has any kind of existence outside of that is just kind of illusionary, you know. But we all know that's not true. And there's scientific evidence that's not true. I mean, there's a wealth of statistically impressive and convincing evidence about, you know, a variety of different, well, what we would call paranormal, what, you know, they're talking about in the context of this experience of cosmic consciousness. Because, yeah, I mean, they are talking about having paranormal experiences, also mystical experiences, you know, of feeling at one, you know, part of the whole. They talk about the one, the all. You know, there's the fundamental one, and then there's the multiplicity of everything, you know, and it's that, you know, being part of that totality, that's the aim of the seeking cosmic consciousness.
I know in many places they used drugs to get to those states of consciousness, and then there were others that did not. They got it by climbing mountaintops or, you know, had personal experiences. But you know, it's coming around again today because there is a definite, there's greater interest in, you know, the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, and, you know, that philosophy comes out with as above, so below as well. And, it's almost as though this information finds a way to touch every generation in one way or another. The philosophy is still there. So there has to be something extraordinarily important, or it wouldn't have survived time.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I think it's rooted in our psyche. You know, it's rooted in our two different hemispheres, I would say, you know, our two different cerebral hemispheres. And this is something I talk about in later books, Secret Teachers and a book called Lost Knowledge of the Imagination, where the kind of the sort of participatory consciousness that the Hermetic teachings aim at evoking, and that Swaloj Lubitsch talks about as the intelligence of the heart. And there's a variety of other ways where you can talk about it as well, but it's this intuitive consciousness in which you feel a part of, you know, the whatever it is that you're observing, whatever it is that you're in this rapport with, as opposed to our usual way of seeing the world as something completely separate from us that we have to take apart, you know, in order to understand. So I'm just saying. So I would say this Hermetic, you know, there's the kind of what I want to say. There's a kind of attitude, a Hermetic attitude, or a Hermetic way of approaching the world. I mean, there's the kind of the tradition in terms of the books, the writings, and, you know, the whole astrological tradition, alchemical tradition, is all that. But then I think there's also, it's a kind of way of looking at things that's fundamentally about synthesis rather than analysis. It's fundamentally about finding relationships between things. It's kind of, you know, analogical. It's a way of looking at things through analogy rather than you know, sort of cause and effect. And so, you know, I think that's related to or linked in or anchored in a whole way of being that's just part of how we are. But we've marginalized that for the last few centuries. But it's not going to go away.
Happened,
it's never gone away.
So what happened to humanity? Because there was a time where this was not only a philosophy that people talked about openly, but practiced openly, and then it suddenly fell from favor, whatever you want to call it. I mean, still kept alive in certain areas and aspects of our cultures, but so what happened to us? Because that was a golden age.
Oh. Well, I say in other books, I think. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, and it's just sort of like, you know, how did we lose the golden age and, you know, come back into an age of mind as opposed to spirit?
Well, it's part of what I write about in other books, and just fundamentally, it's what I would say evolution of consciousness. And so there's good reason to believe that at a very early time in human history, or you know, in prehistory, mostly, that our consciousness was not the way it is now. Like I said, where we have a very sharply defined outer world and an inner world. And, you know, the outer world is what's really real. The physical world is what's really real. And it's something that's completely other from us. And, it, you know, it's completely oblivious to us and so on and so on. And, you know, we learn about it, you know, through trial and error and all that, you know, just how we experience the world. But at an earlier time, it was more like, well, different people have said this. Steiner said this, Gene Gebser, Ian McGilchrist in his book, The Master and His Emissary, about the left and right brain. And other people have said this, so I'm not saying anything new, but actually I'm putting together what these other people have said. And so, but what happened is gradually we lost that because for whatever reason, we took the road of developing our individual egos or individual selves as separate. And there was a great loss, a loss of contact with, you know, the source, or as Gene Gebser calls it, the origin, or the one, or nature. But we gained in freedom. We gained in self-consciousness. This is coming out of the garden, you know. The golden age for me, I would say, is when we didn't have the kind of self-consciousness that we have now. And we became, as Adam and Eve did, became ashamed. It knew they were naked in the Garden of Eden. And suddenly we became aware of ourselves. And I mean, if you look at many of the creation myths in different mythologies, you can see them as fundamentally, they're myths about the appearance of consciousness and your self-consciousness and light and so on and so on. And so that I was, for whatever reason, I mean, I argue in other books that, you know, nature or God or whatever you want to call it, did it on purpose because it's necessary for us to develop individual egos. It's necessary for us to develop independence and so on. And, you know, we lost a lot, but we gained a great deal. But it's part of a longer kind of arc in which that earlier participatory consciousness, which I'm relating to the Hermetic tradition, doesn't go away. We marginalized it, but it's still there. And I would say now, 400 years more or less since the eclipse of Hermes Trismegistus' prestige as an actual, you know, figure, real figure, and hence the authority of the texts. We need to, and I think we've begun to in different ways, start a process of trying to bring these two sides together. Because, as I said, they're housed within our skulls and in our two the different hemispheres of our brain. You know, which, you know, one sees the world very different than the way the other one does. And the kind of one that breaks the world up into fragments in order to understand it, which is absolutely necessary because it's what made us survive and made us dominant. That's become too, it's done its job too well, and it's not allowed, you know, the other side to. But the other side doesn't go away. You know, it appears in a variety of different kinds of expressions, you know, in dreams and in intuitions and, inspirations and, you know, and so on and so on. So I kind of look at it in this long picture where there's a development and the polarity between these two kind of opposing ways of knowing the world, but at times they come together. When they come together, that's when you have these fantastic creative periods.
Yeah, that's when magic happens, absolutely. It's coming to realize that we are not just the physical, but the physical is basically the vehicle the spirit travels in, and the spirit is eternal. So that you know, linking a conscious understanding of the fact that this is a brief moment in time, it is not all there is. It is a piece of all there is, or a stepping stone, if you will. But I think that as with all your books, There is absolutely a piece of inspiration that is, you've written a ton of books. How you could have researched all of them and still, you know, be functional is amazing. So how are you led to what you're going to write about? Because there is this concept in every single one of them that, you know, my frame of reference, my world is the metaphysical world. And so I think part of the reason I'm so attracted to your books is that there is something of a spiritual nature in everything that you've written. So how do you, I mean, I don't think you sit down and just say, now I'm going to write about Madame Blavatsky or Aleister Crowley or, you know,
How are you drawn
to the topics you write about?
Well, I mean, it's the practicalities of you know, writing for a living. So it's very good if you come up with an idea that a publisher is interested in. So with books like Blavatsky, again, it was similar to with my book on Rudolf Steiner. It struck me that there wasn't a good, readable, sympathetic but critical, you know, biography of her. There were biographies that were by, you know, theosophists, devotees. I think her name is Helen Cranston. I think did this massive one that I plundered gleefully, you know, for all the information in it. But you know, it's. Or there's you know, critical ones that can be fun to read, but you know, they're basically, you know, she was a kind of lovable rogue, charlatan, and you know, quite the character, you know, so on and so on. But I just thought, yeah, no, there's a place for a book that took her seriously and was interested and wanted to know. And I wanted to understand, well, exactly who was she and what was she about? So, I mean, for me, it's a question. I write the book to answer the question, basically, to myself. Or I want to know about this. And so the best way to learn about something is write a book about it. I like to read. I read a lot and I make a lot of notes.
Well, you know, Blavatsky, you know, comes across in lots of places as a crazy old lady with a monkey. But you know, when I read your Crowley book, I came away with a totally different take on who he was and what he was doing. So that you really, and with Hermes Trismegistus, I mean, I knew a little of what you wrote about, certainly not the extent that, I mean, I didn't know all of it, but it's fascinating that you seem to be looking for, it's almost like you're that blind statue of justice that holds the scales. You know, you're not looking for the pro or the con, you're just looking for the truth.
Yeah, well, a few people have said to me that, you know, it seems like I'm always trying to get a balance. That is it. I'm trying to say, okay, well, you know, fundamentally, here's how I see it. Here's the information. And I think people can pick up how I sort of read things from the tone, you know, because some things, they're wonderful stories. If nothing else, these people had fantastic lives. I mean, Crowley and Blavatsky had, you know, incredible, for whatever you think of them, and not necessarily enviable lives. You wouldn't necessarily want to have their life, but they did, you know, remarkable things. And then those two had a very good sense of humor too. They were very funny. I mean, Crowley was a bit more dubious character than Blavatsky. I think I don't think she ever hurt anybody, but Crowley was a bit nasty at times. But it's also a question comes up, so one book leads to another. Something. So you write about something and you can't get everything into one book, and there's some things left over, and then you develop, you know, an idea. It's usually a question. There's some kind of question. I mean, with Crowley, he was one of the first people read when I was first interested in all this sort of thing way back in the day when I was in music, and in New York in the 70s. And you know, he was in this context of kind of the rock and roll world and all that. And so I had a Crowley period. I got into it. I practiced the rituals and read the books and, you know, did the exercises and so on and so on. And then after a while, I just got tired of him because it's rather claustrophobic, because he's, you know, in the long run, he's sort of megalomaniac, and he just likes to talk about himself a great deal. And he can be very funny. He's a wonderful raconteur in his confessions and all that. But I just, in the long run, got felt very claustrophobic in it. And I left that. But then years later, I saw that there was all this kind of academic interest in him. And I just was really surprised that he had gone from being, you know, the wickedest man in the world and the beast. And then, you know, there's people doing PhD theses on his work. And I thought, oh, that's quite an interesting turnaround. And I just wondered, you know, so what was the story? Did I miss out on something? You know, maybe I should check him out again. And I also wanted to answer the question why he remained a kind of rock and roll icon out of the 1960s. That's when he was rediscovered. But, you know, people like Matt Lubatsky were discovered then as well. And others like Jung. Jung is on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's with Crowley. And so on,
yeah.
But you know they didn't stay kind of rock and roll icons or pop culture icons in the same way that Crowley did, because he was picked up by rap artists, you know, later on, and all that. And so I was kind of looking at that and how I got interested in rock and roll. So I was sort of a bit telling my own story, trying to understand his story. I mean, in the long run, I think he's a kind of cautionary tale. Because I think he was a man of genius. He was certainly brilliant in many ways, but you know, he just had personality problems. He was completely oblivious to the people and completely focused on himself.
Yeah, but he was basically searching for unity with the One. He was looking for, you know, he was looking for the cosmic gnosis that you know everybody does search. He was doing it in his own way, but. You know, I came away from reading. I only read one of your books on him, but I think in India, I think is the one I read.
Right.
We've talked about that one, but I came away with a better understanding, as I did with the Russia book, that that there was a side to them that I had not known of or seen, and once you put all the sides together, at least as much as you've got, you have another way of looking at this person or these people or this situation. I mean, and back to Hermes Trismegistus, I mean, I still prefer to think of him as a man. I mean, I understand he's not, but philosophy,
yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, he's a man. He encompasses a philosophy that I find very comfortable, and I think anybody who reads the book will, once they've gotten through it, and you know, I think your books, fortunately or unfortunately, are the kind of books you have to go through more than once. But this puts things in a different perspective for people, and you know, they can buy it or not buy it. But you know, I'm fascinated with the Emerald Tablets. I'm fascinated with all of that material. So having a little bit of background as to how that came apart, the Emerald Tablets, 8th century,
sure.
You know, basically.
Sure.
But then you get into people like Dr. Dural, who channeled all of his material from the Great White Brotherhood on the Emerald Tablets. And again, here's the philosophy coming at you in a different way, symbolically different, but coming at you.
Yeah.
And it makes everybody think about their own spiritual journey, which I'm in love with, because everybody's journey is different. But you know, have some information, understand where it comes from, understand, you know, Plato and Socrates and all of these guys, they weren't just, you know, old men sitting around. They were people that were digging into the meaning of consciousness. They were talking consciousness, and I think today people don't understand that getting heavy duty into understanding our purpose in the cosmos, our consciousness, you know, where it's been, where it's going. This is a topic that has been spoken about for thousands of years. It's not just new to
the
20th or 21st century. Yeah.
Mm. No, it's fundamental questions of human reality. So that's why Plato and the Hermetic books and all the, you know, great religious and spiritual traditions and philosophies, they're all relevant because they all deal with these fundamental issues that are the same all the time. You know, why do I exist? Why does the world exist? What's going on? Can I speak to the director, please? You know, where's that's, you know, I mean, and this, you know, the thing is that we are in a historically, where, you know, we have a long heritage behind us, you know, a long tradition behind us. And we live in this post everything world now today, where, you know, all of the things from the past, all of the sort of what they say, the narratives or the ideas of how we saw ourselves, you know, whether it's religious or, you know, scientific or in terms of progress or, you know, whatever, all these have kind of become, you know, unbelievable. You know, we don't understand ourselves. And so we're in the position of, like when the existentialists said in the early 20th century, that we find ourselves thrown into the world and we just don't know what we're here for. So, I mean, one of the reasons why there's a popular interest in, say, the Hermetic tradition or a variety of other kind of spiritual traditions that are outside the mainstream churches or not the scientific, is that they offer some possibility of getting some kind of answer to that question. And fundamentally, in these traditions, what it has to do is with an experience. It's not just the teaching. It's not like a dogma. That's the main difference between, say, the esoteric or the hermetic or the Gnostic kind of traditions of spirituality, rather than the sort of mainstream, you know, orthodox churches, is that they ask for faith and they offer dogma. So you're given something to believe, but you're not necessarily given an experience of it. And you're not necessarily given a kind of knowledge as a kind of inner knowledge. But that's what the Hermetic traditions offer. I mean, whether you actually achieve it or not is up to you. It's up to your efforts. But they're fundamentally about practices that provide a kind of felt experience of the kind of knowledge.
How much further ahead do you think you come to?
When they're talking about... what do you mean?
Now, how much further ahead do you think we would be if the library at Alexandria had not been burned?
God, who knows? Who knows what was lost? You know, what can you say? I mean, it's one of those things you never. I mean, there's many things that we only have reference to. We know they existed at one point, but there's no copies of them. But we know other copies of text mention them. So there's many things that we know were in the library that we'll never see. So, you know, sadly that happens. I mean, one of the things that I do say in the book is that this collection, the Hermetica, this collection of writings, it itself got lost after sort of the, you know, in Alexandria, this from Alexandria. And only bits of it were available for 1,000 years. And when it was rediscovered in the Renaissance, in the sort of late 1400s. It was rediscovered precisely because of a huge historical eruption, the fall of Constantinople to the Turks. And so all these churchmen and scholars were fleeing, you know, it's Istanbul today, but all the churchmen and scholars were fleeing Constantinople and they were selling their libraries. And Cosimo de' Medici, who was the big power broker in Florence, He was a book lover, and he had a book scout out there, and he scooped up all these books, and what he brought back was, and you have to remember, this is the end of the Dark Ages, or I call them the Dim Ages, because, you know, it's not supposed to call them the Dark Ages, so the Dim Ages, in any case.
Okay.
It was back, I mean, all these Greek, we lost all that. That's precisely where that's precisely why they were the Dark Ages, and precisely why the Renaissance was the Renaissance, because they were rediscovered. But the point I'm making is that, you know, these frail scrolls of, you know, paper on which these magical and mystical, you know, writings were survived through, you know, eruptions and wars and invasions and all this kind of thing. So there's this kind of metaphor of the life of the spirit, you know, survives through all of the chaos of the world. I mean, you know, there's a wonderful passage in another Hermetic text called the Asclepius, where they sort of bemoan the fact that the people have lost faith and they no longer, you know, pray to the gods and they no longer perform the rituals. And there's a whole sense that, you know, the great days are gone and the dark days are coming. And this is in ancient Egypt. And it's applicable to, you know, well, it would have been, you know, it was very applicable to the last several years in contemporary time, but not to be too over enthusiastic, but perhaps some of that's changed with recent events. Uh-huh. But I think the thing, you know, at the end of the book, I talk, it's about this notion of this kind of Hermesian spirit. It's a spirit of bringing things together, and it's a spirit of asking questions rather than having answers. That's the kind of tradition. I like a tradition that asks good questions rather than one that provides answers. And that's the difference between kind of a dogmatic kind of, okay, here's, you know, this is the strict, the word, this is how it is, and we're not going to alter any of it. And, you know, if you follow this, you'll be saved. And the other is more dangerous and uncertain, but if you put up with that uncertainty, this kind of hovering, you're able to experiment with a variety of different, you know, ways of seeing things and putting things together. And again, it's precisely what you were saying. It's about seeing the world in a different way. It's about, and this is one of the things, one of the people who influenced me a lot, in a book of mine called The Lost Knowledge of the Imagination, is dedicated to her. It's Kathleen Raine, and she was a poet, an essayist, and a Blake scholar. She said that the imagination doesn't see different things, it sees things differently.
Yeah.
So it's not new facts. We're not looking for new facts. We're looking for a new way of looking at the facts we already have. And this is a different, you know, point of view. It's a different way of interpreting the data, put it that way, that we have. And again, the Hermetic philosophy is about seeing the world itself as symbolic. You know, it's the notion of correspondences, as above, so below. So the phenomena of the world are symbolic of higher realities, you know, in the spiritual realms.
Well, I tell everybody that, you know, you create your world by your perception of it. And if you don't like something, perceive it differently. It does work. I think that this is a book I would highly recommend that everybody read, because it does make you understand to a greater degree really the control you have over so much in your life, and it's a matter of taking that power back from yourself. You know, we're taught things, you know, by parents, by teachers, by society, by culture, by lots of different things, we put ourselves in cages, and the only way to get out of it is to break out, and you have to do that from inside. You it's not something you do from outside. If it were a conscious thing, it would be so much easier. But it's not. It's a higher consciousness striving to make a point to the consciousness. And I think everybody's going through this kind of battle, especially at this particular point in time. And so understanding that there are philosophies out there, there are, you know, we're walking pathways that have been walked before, but you can't follow another's pathway. So you have to understand that there are always options and, you know, be creative about finding them. Because once you're creative, you open yourself up to a whole new channel of energy that's within you. So, I just noticed the time. I want to thank you so much for being here and talking with me. And I know that you have tons of other people you're going to be talking to. So, I am so glad that you could squeeze us in. This material is profound. We could go on for hours and hours and hours, but maybe just an hour is enough for some people to get so fascinated with the thought of looking at the quest for Hermes Trismegistus that they will buy the book and read it themselves. So,
well, I hope so. And,
Me too.
I mean, that's the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing is to have curiosity and to want to learn about things. So that's, I would say that's the fundamental key to changing reality, is you learn about a bigger one. And, you know, you rise up out of, you know, where you are at the moment, and you see further horizons of meaning and understanding and knowledge. And that in itself is a remarkable, you know, experience.
Absolutely. And understanding that there are always options, and you just have to quiet yourself to let them come into your consciousness. They're there. But I don't have the option of stretching this time any further. So, Gary, I want
to
thank you again.
Well, thanks. Yeah, well, absolutely my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks again, and thank you, everybody, for listening. It was my pleasure to talk with Gary today, and hopefully some of you out there will check out his amazing library of books he's written and check into some of the material he's put out there to challenge you. Take care, everybody. Talk to you soon.